Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
2 years of Nature Talk Radio. A lot has changed in the last 2 years because a lot has happened. And it's all documented in the Wildside News archives. Today, we visit with some voices from the past to see what they are voicing today when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wildside News. Welcome to our second anniversary show. Over the last 2 years, the Wildside News has talked to over 275 guests on topics as diverse as frog behavior, trails, national parks, the death of environmentalism, animal intelligence, and so much more. And we look forward to continuing into year three. A lot has happened in these last 2 years. Personally, I've watched an awareness of the role of nature and the environment in our lives move from a secondary concern to, well, let's find out what's on people's minds. In the next two segments, you'll be hearing from some previous guests to see what they are thinking about today. In this segment, we hear from Ron Miles, naturalist from Minnesota, Peter Larson, who was uncovering a T-Rex known as Y-Rex, Dennis Hayes, who is generally recognized as one of the founders of Earth Day, and Jim DePeso, spokesman for Republicans for the Environment. So we start our conversation with Ron Miles, who recently retired as a naturalist from the Minnesota State Park System. Ron is always probing deeply into the mystery and crafts his journey in words well chosen.
Frankly, I just finished reading 1491. Well, Charles Mann has... it's a pretty, hot seller, if you will, at the moment. And it's a changing paradigm. Look at the Western Hemisphere based on archaeological macro evidence, you know, that only with today's technology can be put together into enough of a perspective and profile that the degree to which Western environments were cultural instead of natural is rather overwhelming by the evidence, and at least that's the that's what this big compendium does. I'm not saying that it's a monster monograph. It's a sampling, and it's popularized, but it's a very, very intriguing sort of thing.
What does that mean, cultural instead of natural?
Well, it means that the reason that the biology is as it is, or was even when Columbus came, was that it had been manipulated by humans for dramatically for long, long periods of time, and with irrigation, with fire, and the, you know, the evidence is definitely there. I mean, of course, the specter of disease has played monster games many times in the past, and a lot of things that have happened on our continent were artifacts of Europeans, and of course what they did, what they set in motion, either inadvertently or otherwise, as far as their subjecting changes in, you know, a lot of the things that we have rather blithely referred to as wilderness is that's the other thing, and that it's kind of a difficult thing to chew on a little bit right now, because in the wrong hands that could be used to weaken any sort of fabric of protection laws that we have. And you know, in Republican hands, that's that's disaster. But
how is it that this concept of wilderness would be weakened? I'm trying to understand that better. I'm sure you have an answer.
I didn't say that it would. I said that it could, because of the way that people who wish to continue present economic exploitation trends into the future can easily fall back on the use of arguments that it wasn't wild to begin with. I think you'd enjoy reading it, and I'm still finishing it myself, but it's worth reading.
The last time we talked with Peter Larson, he was in the middle of unearthing a T-Rex from a secret location and documenting the entire process on a wonderful website. So what's he been up to?
Well, I think the last time we talked, we were actually digging Y-Rex, the T-Rex, which is our eighth T-Rex specimen. And right now we're actually doing preparation on it, and we found some pretty interesting things, including skin and the third finger for a T-Rex. Everybody probably remembers how T-Rex is only supposed to have two fingers. Well, it actually has, at least within the palm, a third digit. We have not found an actual finger that sits on that, but we found a bone that we didn't know for sure existed. We suspected it did, but we've got one for sure now.
How far along are you in reconstructing Y-Rex?
Well, we've gotten now about half of the skeleton, or close to half of the skeleton, cleaned. We'll be going back out again this summer in hopes of finding some more of that dinosaur. The final turtle count, if you remember, that one of our theories was it was killed by a stampede of turtles.
Yeah.
We were up to 22 turtles now.
Wow.
Of course, the stampede is a joke, but it's kind of fun.
Do you think perhaps that there was some sort of miring of the turtles in some sort of mud base or something like that? Or why so many?
I think
or just a lake, maybe.
They're right on the edge of a lake, and I think that the turtle carcasses and the T-Rex carcass were basically washed up on this edge of the lake. And by perhaps a storm, there's what we call clasts, or rip-up clasts, showing that there was really very active water. The water was really moving around and kind of ripping up the bottom. So there was maybe a storm that kind of pushed these things out to the leeward side of the lake and dumped them. So the actual cause of death has not yet been determined for Y-Rex. It may, like most dinosaurs, is very difficult to see the cause of death. We can look at healed injuries and tell what happened during its life, but in most cases it's almost an impossibility to actually get the cause of death.
Now, I actually haven't checked out your website in a while. Are you still doing updates on...
We do. We haven't updated for a while, but there are some more recent updates, including you'll see a photograph of the skin, and I think we have a photograph of the digits we have, or the bones we have for the hand, too, and found most of one arm, which is really cool, and some of the skull bones, I think, are maybe pictured up there, too, anyway, we will be doing some more updates here probably within the next 30 days or so.
Do you have any new discoveries in line here to head out and to work on?
One of the things we're going to do this summer is we're, of course, going to be exploring for new sites, but we're also going to visit a couple of the T-Rex sites again, and which we've opened up again and let weather, getting a couple of feet above the bones, or about 12 inches above where we think the bone layer begins. And using our maps that we've gone back to try to figure out where we might find more bones. And so we'll be revisiting a couple of our sites, including Stan, which is the second most complete one we've collected to date.
How long do you expect it's going to take before you fully assemble what you have there?
Y-Rex it'll be probably another 2 years before we finish the work and mounting of the dinosaur.
Mm-hmm. Anything specifically that you've discovered that you didn't know when we talked before?
Well, the two things, the hand, we looked like we had a hand, some of the hand, but also we discovered most of the arm, which was not at all visible. And also the skin, which we had not seen at all. I had perhaps postulated that we might because of the type of preservation that, and lo and behold, when we got the specimen home and started working on it, we started finding skin, and we've got about a dozen patches of it now.
Now, is that something that's rare?
The first T-Rex skin that's ever been found.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
So that's pretty cool.
What's it look like? Give me a visual.
It looks kind of like a coarse leather, almost like the surface you see on leather. So it has the skin would look somewhat like an elephant skin, except finer textured.
Mm-hmm. Was there hair as well?
Well, interestingly enough, we have one thing that looks like a downy feather, very three-dimensional, and it may or may not be a feather, and even if it is a feather, we can't say for sure that it's T-Rex unless, and we're hoping, we're going to really, as we're cleaning these patches of skin, we're really looking, because if we can find some of them attached to the skin, we know that they were on T-Rex.
Wow, that would be totally different. One doesn't usually visualize T-Rex with feathers. It kind of changes the whole monster image.
Well, remember, T-Rex is more distantly related to Triceratops than it is to the hummingbird.
Interesting.
So it's closer related to a hummingbird. So we would finding feathers on it would be what we would actually, those of us who work on these guys, that's what we would expect.
That's good science. Well, listen, if people want to find out what you're doing these days, how can they do so?
Well, they can check us out at the Wyrex site, which is unearthingtrex.com, or they can visit us at bhigr.com, which tells us what the whole business is doing at the time, and lots of pictures of dinosaurs and some fun science stuff there. And
well, I tell you what, I enjoyed our conversation a year or something back very much. It was really a great adventure, and we'll keep in touch.
Okay. Kind of fun. You have a very fun show.
Thank you so much, Peter.
You take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye. In 1 month, the world will be celebrating Earth Day. Dennis Hayes was there during the first Earth Day and is recognized as one of its founders. As we approach the 36th Earth Day, we hear what Dennis Hayes is thinking about.
Well, we've hit that point in the climate issue now where the majority of Americans, the vast majority, has now come to understand what the vast majority of relevant scientists has known for a long time, that it's real. And the real debate is increasingly moved on to where is the tipping point? Where is the point of no return? Where do you start getting into abrupt climate change of ways that cause Katrina-like things with greater regularity? And that gets to be a very scary kind of situation, particularly in a world where the largest emitter of greenhouse gases as a federal government is refusing to recognize the problem or to do anything meaningful about it. And it's caused me to begin to think in a way that may be even a little bit flaky about how we perceive things through the lenses of the world that surrounds us, and the world that surrounds us right now is a world of nation states. So climate has been approached by trying to get all sorts of nations, 141 of them, to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. But the nation state is a weird kind of construct that views China and the Vatican and the United States and the Central African Republic all as sort of the same things. It's as weird as the Electoral College in many ways. And we've learned now that when the federal government here won't do something, that doesn't mean that nothing can be done. And so one of the things that I'm deeply involved in right now is that the mayor of Seattle reached out to a bunch of other mayors and asked them to ratify the Kyoto Protocols on behalf of their citizens. We, at last count, had 115 mayors representing 43 million Americans in more than 30 states, bipartisan, who have done this. Stage one is pretty easy. You sign a piece of paper. It's a little bit political smoke and mirrors. And we're now getting to stage two. I mean, this week, the mayor of Seattle is announcing what he's going to be doing as a result of this citizens commission that's been working for the last several months to design a program for him to actually move it. So in Seattle, to work on climate, because our electric utility is already climate neutral. It's a much more difficult task than for any other city in America. We're still going to be pushing electrical efficiency because it's an important thing to do, but we don't get a single Kyoto credit for saving electricity because it's carbon neutral. So we have to move on transportation, and we're moving on automobiles and on public transportation, on planes, on what ships do when they come into the Seattle docks, working on industry to see what we can do to clean up industrial energy. Tougher things with real political costs attached to it. And this stage is now one where the mayor is bellying up to the bar and being quite politically courageous on it. And it gives me hopes that, even though the American government isn't doing things, around the world this stuff is going to be implemented not just by nations, but by nations, by provinces, by cities, by neighborhoods, by individuals. We all need to pull together, and I'm just delighted that in this country the cities are deciding to take this leadership role.
That is really the message that's come forth in about the last 2 years, is that you'll find a lot of schools, for example, that are beginning to say, you know, let's put in the solar. Let's just get it done. The state portfolio standards that are being set up are really taking the lead in making a difference. So it's very interesting to see how you're applying this in the Seattle area.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And in a lot of these schools, and colleges and universities for the most part, it's student pressure. Somebody's going to be building a new dormitory, and the students put on the pressure, and a rich alumnus comes in and says, hey, I'll pay the incremental cost to put the solar on the rooftops. It really is wonderful leadership. And now with renewable portfolio standards, a lot of them, the early days, they were done by public utility commissions. Last year, Colorado took it to the voters, and the voters approved it in a statewide initiative. And we also couldn't get it through the Public Utility Commission in Washington, so it's going to the voters in Washington State this year on an initiative. I mean, it's just people deciding we can't wait and moving to change companies as well. I mean, here's one of the really interesting things. The environmental movement for decades really worked in the traditional way that activist groups that have been fighting wars or fighting for civil rights or fighting for the environment have done. It was to lobby the federal government to put constraints around companies and put constraints around states. Today, the federal government is so resolutely anti-environmental in the executive, legislative, and judiciary branches that increasingly environmentalists are working with companies to put pressure on the government to do a decent job, and working similarly with states and cities to set good examples.
What's so interesting about that is the fact that we're all learning and progressing, and we're finding out that most of the people actually who run those companies are just like you and me. We're aware, we're conscious, we have families and kids and communities, and we understand that it's up to us, and we can actually make those differences. It's a whole new, I think there's a whole new thing that's beginning to happen here, and it's about time.
Yeah, the CEOs of several of the Fortune 500 companies, I'm sure, are the right age that they were out on that very first Earth Day planting trees somewhere.
Well, Dennis, I want to thank you for your thoughts. I know you're a very busy guy, and we're going to talk again down the road here, and any time that you want to share your thoughts, you contact me.
Great, Sydney.
If people want to find out more about the Bullitt Foundation and what you're doing, what's the best way to do so?
www.bullitt.org. But I'd really recommend for your audience, which is a broad audience, that particularly now in March with Earth Day coming up early in April, that they go to www.earthday.net and see how they can plug in and be doing something themselves in their own communities on April 22nd.
That's the next big moment in terms of this this movement that started quite a long time ago, and that you are very much a key player in initiating. Congratulations.
Thanks, Sydney.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Dennis. It's 2006, and it's an election year. The red state, blue state battles of 2004 will likely resurface. Jim DePeso is the spokesman for REP. We find out what's on Jim's mind in this election year.
I think the primary issue that is facing our country, and I think the realization is really sinking in, is that we have to do something about global warming. There's just simply no longer any credible argument that human activities are changing the climate, and that is a very risky thing to do, and it's time for our country to step up. And the longer we delay, the harder it's going to get our hands around the problem and reduce the risks of some very serious consequences.
What has made you come to this this conclusion? As I totally agree with you that it's reached critical mass in the minds of many people around the world. Is there anything in particular that's brought you to this point?
Well, I think it's the fact that more scientists have come to the realization that climate change is not necessarily a gradual process, but that we could cross thresholds that could lead to some very dangerous changes in the behavior of the climate systems. The atmosphere, as past records have shown, or the climate, I should say, as past records have shown, can be very twitchy, and changes can take place in the space of a few years. And it's like we are car driving hard toward a cliff in the fog. We don't know where those thresholds are, where those tipping points are. We know they're there. And the more emissions that we put into the atmosphere, greenhouse gas emissions, the more chances that we're taking that we're going to cross one of those thresholds, and that could result in irreversible consequences.
Jim, you represent Republicans for Environmental Protection. What would you call an intelligent and informed Republican response to this situation?
I think that where too many of our Republican leaders have gone wrong on this issue is they have this very pessimistic outlook on how on the ability of our country's people and businesses to respond to a challenge. I think what they have overlooked, many lessons from our past, is that when our leaders really educate our citizens and say, this is what's going on, this is what we need to do about it, we need everybody to help out and participate, people will rally around and say, yes, well, let's see what we can do, and we can pull miracles out of the hat. And this has been done many times in our country's history. Where our leaders today are falling short is they seem to be selling their own citizens short. They seem to be overtly pessimistic about the ability of our country to respond to this challenge, and I think that you could almost say that tinges on lack of patriotism.
One of the interesting things is the fact that businesses, in many cases, as you're well aware, are definitely responding to this and seeing a two-sided advantage. One is that they can actually make a lot of money, because we're talking in many cases about energy, which is big business, putting people back to work, using the creative spirit of American engineering and technology and inventiveness, and they see it kind of from a different perspective. Many people do.
Yeah, and I think businesses are leading the way. More and more businesses are seeing that not only are there risks involved, it's up to risks involved with doing nothing, but there are opportunities with taking action. And in many cases, the politicians are at the end of the line when it comes to understanding what risks are and understanding what opportunities are available. Spin-off benefits if we make a serious crack at resolving this problem. So, again, I think the politicians are selling their constituents short. They are not remembering the lessons of our own of our country's own history, and I think that is just a shameful behavior on their part.
Mm-hmm. Jim, if people want to find out what you're doing these days, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, they should visit our website, www.rep.org.
Very good. Thanks, Jim.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sydney.
It wasn't more than a few months ago that energy independence was at the forefront of national news. And today, it seems global warming is hot. In just a moment, we return with updates from around the country for more of the guests who have made these last 2 years so very meaningful. When the voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.